Locavore sounds like the answer to one of Will's puzzles, but the local food movement has inspired many people to get in touch with their inner farmer. That's especially easy during the harvest season at farm dinners across the country. Weekend Edition food commentator Bonnie Wolf explains.
Farm to fork takes on a whole new meaning when you have dinner in the middle of a pasture with cows. From spring through fall, you can probably find a farm near your neighborhood where a professional chef will serve an elegant multi-course meal of local foods grown by the farmer sitting next to you. One New Hampshire farm features a dinner with meat from pigs, pasture-fed on pure sunshine, and there's a hayride. In Minnesota, a family-friendly farm dinner includes live bluegrass music, a bonfire, and overnight camping. All tableware is compostable. Midwest farmland is also celebrated at dinner among the fruits and vegetables in the Chicago Botanic Garden. Most dinners start with cocktails and a farm tour. Then the chefs and farmers talk about each course as it's served. Dinners are organized by the farmers or put together by farm dinner companies. Meals in the Meadows started about 10 years ago before sustainable was a common vocabulary word. The idea is to connect eaters with the people who cook and grow their food. Now that even bean sprouts can be contaminated, we want to go to the source. One pioneer is surfer artist chef Jim Denovan. His company, called Outstanding in the Field, last year served 10,000 diners across North America. Outstanding sets up its signature single long white cloth covered table at sites like a natural cave on a Bay Area beach below a soaring cliff serving fish from local waters. At the other extreme, dinner at a rooftop farm in Queens. Some farm dinners are under tents, but most are under the sky. Judy Gifford of St. Bridget's Farm in Maryland says sitting out in the open at one long table is part of the magic. Of course, there is always weather. For the first St. Bridget's farm dinner, it poured. So they moved into the new barn, used tiki torches for light, and empty water troughs for wine and beer. Gifford says it was great. These experiences do not come cheap. Outstanding in the Field charges at least $200 per person for a seat at the communal table. Most farm dinners are $100 and up. Many farms donate all or a portion of their proceeds, while the companies are run for profit. Why do people go? Well, if you grow it, cook it, and serve it, they will come.
Bonnie Wolf is working on a book about the foods of Maryland's Eastern Shore. For many wine drinkers, summer is the season to enjoy white wines. They can be light and crisp with subtle citrus flavors, just the right balance on a steamy afternoon. Our next guest says Riesling is the perfect summer wine, the greatest grape on the planet, in fact. Riesling aficionado Paul Greco is a James Beard award-winning sommelier, and he co-owns, Mr. Greco, you're going to have to help me pronounce the name of your wine bar.
Terroir Wine Bar.
Also Hearth Restaurant in Manhattan, and he joins us from our New York bureau. Welcome.
Linda, how are you?
I'm good, and I think I'm about to be better. Now, I assume that Rieslings are underappreciated by people who are very serious about wine because most people think of them as sort of sweet and soda poppy. Isn't that right?
Absolutely. I think for a lot of people through the 60s and 70s and 80s, the Rieslings that they enjoyed from Germany were sweeter then. And so this belief came about that all Riesling was sweet. And that's so wrong because Riesling has absolute balance. When examples do have residual sugar, they also have back-breaking acidity to balance it out. In this day and age, where conversations in the wine world talk about too much alcohol or too much oak or extracted fruit, et cetera, balance is something that we don't address often enough. And once again, Riesling has it in spades.
Now, you sent us three varieties at three different price points. So let's have a tasting.
Absolutely. We're going to begin our journey in the home. In Germany, of course, there are 13 wine regions. This is a smaller region called the Saar. The producer is Peter Lauer. It comes from the town of Eil. The Kupp, K-U-P-P, is the name of the vineyard. It's a bottling in honor of his grandfather, and that's why he calls it Senior. And this harkens back to an older style of German Riesling. So we're going to taste it together. Riesling has awesome aromatics, whole range of fruits.
It certainly does.
Cherries to apples to pears. There's notes of flowers in there, rose, lavender. It's exciting just thinking about this stuff. And great minerality. So you, how can you stop smelling this wine? You can't. Let's have a taste.
Mm-hmm. No, I can't. I can't do that great slurpy tasting thing that you were just doing. But this is delicious. It's very light. I've been known to drink lots cheaper wine, but this is not bad. $26.
One might say for that lack of appreciation in the marketplace, you can find great Riesling for not a lot of shekels.
Okay, so the French Riesling, this is from Alsace, which is a part of France that might as well be German. I mean, and has been at various times in history German.
In trying the German first and now the Alsace, you have roughly the two European poles of Riesling, lean, mean, piercing acidity in the German, and now we go to Alsace, where they tend to be bigger, fatter, richer, completely different soil structure here, more limestone in this Alsace example. Let's have a taste together.
Mm-hmm.
See how broad it is?
Mm-hmm.
The first wine went right down the middle. That's Germany. This one goes out to the sides.
You mean like of your tongue, down the middle and
exactly,
on the sides?
Exactly, straight down the middle.
Wow.
Very linear. You know, if I could do a fashion reference, for instance, I think the wine number one, the Peter Lauer, is more like a Paul Smith suit, squared off shoulders, where this Alsace example is more like a Hugo Boss or an Armani. The slope shoulders, everything just falls off gently and coats the entire palate.
Hmm. It's a little more expensive. This one is $35. So now we are going to take a U-turn and go to Austria.
Absolutely. Now, this will be right in the middle. Austrian Rieslings, in general, because there are no absolutes in wine, they have the brilliant, piercing, linear acidity of the German, but also the fatness, the power of Alsace.
And they have a price which indicates that they have grand aspirations. This was a little more expensive, $42.
You're paying that money for this piece of property. This wine is made by Brundelmeier. It's from the town of Zobing, and it's from a very specific vineyard called Heiligenstein. And we get volcanic soil, desert sands, crystalline rock, and you're going to sense a power in this wine that is truly extraordinary. So you have to pay for that privilege of drinking this very unique vineyard.
Okay. I'm trying it.
You notice right off the bat on the nose, fruit-driven, but a little bit more herbaceous,
mm-hmm.
green, wet grass, maybe a little bit of rosemary in there too, and stony. It's as if you're biting into a big rock. That is, that's terroir. And that's one thing that Riesling does that a lot of other grapes don't, because it's Riesling is unencumbered by oak. Riesling will not taste like you're biting into a 2x4.
How should we take care of them? I mean, should we serve them cold? How cold?
I think certainly if we keep your fridge at 38, 40, 42 degrees Fahrenheit, that's perfectly fine. But when you pull them out, give them 20 minutes to warm up a little bit. I think in this country we serve our white wines too cold. And also we serve our red wines too warm. Maybe put your red wine in the fridge if you're going to have that with dinner. When you take the white wine out, give it 20 to 30 minutes of chill.
So is that why you think Riesling is good for summer, that it doesn't mind being warm?
Well, I think Riesling is great for summer because of the inherent acidity in the wine. It cleanses your palate. This is a winter reference. It's a Zamboni. Zamboni goes on the ice between periods, cleans the ice, lays down a brand new sheet of ice so we can go out and play hockey again. Acid does the same thing to your palate. You have a bite of food off the barbecue, sip of wine, cleans the palate, another bite of food, sip of wine, acid cleans the palate. It just refreshes you, it perks you up, makes you have a second glass of wine, makes you have a second bottle. Nothing greater than that.
Paul Greco is a highly regarded sommelier, a Manhattan restaurateur. He spoke with us from New York about the fine points of Riesling. Thank you very much.
Linda, my pleasure.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, the Barbershop Guys give their take on the effort to get a deal on the deficit and the debt ceiling and the breakthrough in the labor agreement with the National Football League. That's in just a few minutes. But first, more of our interview with President Barack Obama. He spoke with us yesterday from the Oval Office. Earlier, we talked about the ongoing negotiations over reducing the federal debt and raising the debt ceiling. We talked about unemployment and his critics within the black community. Then I asked him about the other person catching some flack in the White House, his wife, Michelle. You're not the only Obama in the White House who's faced some criticism of late. You know, the First Lady, Mrs. Obama, was criticized for a high-calorie meal that she ordered at the Shake Shack, which is a new popular burger spot in Washington, D.C. And I wonder if you think that that's fair or do you think that's out of bounds?
Michelle doesn't take that too seriously. Michelle knows that, well, let me put it this way. Michelle's never hid the fact that her favorite food is French fries or that she's going to have a burger once in a while. The whole point that she's been making, which is common sense, and so this should be a non-issue, is how do we make sure that our kids in particular have balanced meals on a regular basis? Because it'll make them healthier, it'll make them do better in school, and it forms lifelong habits that will improve their quality of life. And, you know, I think that she has been adamant about saying that there's nothing wrong with having a treat once in a while. There's nothing wrong with going ahead and having a milkshake or a piece of pie or whatever else you crave. The question is, what is it that on a regular basis you're doing, and what can we do as a society to make sure that, for example, folks in low-income communities have access to a grocery store that actually sells fresh produce. And in fact, they did a wonderful announcement yesterday talking about food deserts, communities where you cannot, in any reasonable way find fresh and healthy foods. And if you do find it, then the prices are jacked up in those communities. And there was an announcement, cooperation from a whole bunch of retailers all across the country. They're going to start building new stores that will not only create jobs, but also give people healthier options. And that's what this is all about, empowering people to have better options so that they can make better decisions for their family. Okay. It's not about people not having a hamburger once in a while.
Okay, but did she get the sweet potato fries or the regular? Never mind, I'm not asking.
You know,
that.
She likes both, actually.
She likes the sweet potato fries
and the
regular.
You should try them in the White House, too, because sometimes we make them and they're outstanding.
All right, well, before we let you go, you got a big birthday coming up in 2 weeks, and it's the big, can we mention this, the big 5-0?
You know, I feel real good about 5-0. Obviously, I've gotten a little grayer since I took this job, but otherwise I feel pretty good. And Michelle, says that, she still thinks I'm cute, you know, and I guess that's all that matters, isn't it?
Well, do you want anything special that we should pass along?
Well,
anything special?
You know what I really want right now is to get a debt ceiling deal for my birthday. That's kind of sad, I know.
And maybe some French fries.
And maybe some, maybe I'll have a good hamburger on my birthday as well.
President Barack Obama joined us on the line from the White House. Thank you, Mr. President.
Enjoyed talking to you. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Why is it when you go to the grocery store, you can find a dozen kinds of apples? You got your Macintosh, your Red Delicious, your Granny Smiths. You got other varieties of fruit like your tangerines, your tangelos, your mandarin oranges, your red and green seedless grapes. Big variety there. But there's only one kind of banana. There are thousands of varieties of bananas, but the big U.S. banana suppliers grow only one that we can get. The Cavendish. So that's the one we eat, and we eat a lot of them, billions and billions of pounds each year. We slice them on our oatmeal and our cornflakes. We whip them up in smoothies. We rely on them as a backbone of the banana split. But could our favorite fruit soon become history? Well, a lethal fungus is spreading through Cavendish banana plantations in Asia and Australia. What happens if it makes its way to Latin America, where the U.S. banana supply is grown? Joining me now to talk more about it is Dan Coppell, science writer and author of Banana, The Fate of the Fruit That Changed the World. He joins us from KPCC. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you so much.
Is it true that the song, Yes, We Have No Bananas, was written because of a shortage of bananas once?
Well, the original banana that Americans came to know was called the Gros Michel banana, and that one was wiped out by a blight between 1906 and 1960. That song appeared in the 1920s, and it's likely that there were banana shortages during that time. I can't say that the writers of the song were aware of this, just like most people aren't aware of it now, but I would like to believe that it had something to do with it, and it's not a complete myth.
And you say that just like the Gros Michel bananas were wiped out by a disease, that we may be headed toward another wipeout.
Correct. That disease that killed Gros Michel, which was actually a better-tasting, better banana than what we eat now, the Cavendish, was called Panama disease. It's a fungal wilt. And in fact, what's killing Cavendish is another version of that very same disease. Cavendish was adopted because it was resistant to the original version of Panama disease, but it is not resistant to this newly discovered strain, and that's a big problem.
So why, as I mentioned in my introduction, we have all these varieties of other fruits and vegetables. Why do we only have one banana to choose from?
Well, I like to answer that by asking, why don't we have filet mignon, pad thai, and tofu scrambles at McDonald's?
Okay.
The banana is the cheapest fruit in the supermarket, and that's pretty weird because it is shipped from great distances, and it requires a lot of handling and refrigeration, much more than apples, for example. To do that, the banana industry has, for 100 years, had a business model that focuses on a single product. That's the McDonald's comparison. And I like to tell people, imagine a pipe from Ecuador to your supermarket that can only fit one variety of the world's 1,000 banana varieties. And that's basically the way it works. That's why bananas are so cheap. In order to bring new bananas, you have to build entirely new infrastructure, ranging from plantation to shipping to packing methods and to ways to tell consumers about it.
But you would think that the banana people who control the banana flow would know that there is a fungus among us out there someplace and headed in our direction.
Well, they know. They didn't admit it for a long time. Just a couple of years ago, Chiquita started talking about it, and Chiquita also has been doing some work on developing alternate varieties. But for the most part, the history of the industry has been to look at chemical means of control for blight. And to stick to this monocultural business model, because that's all they know. And in some ways, you can think of them as maybe the old department stores of the 1970s or Digital Equipment Corporation, some of these hidebound tech companies that couldn't change and disappeared. I'm not predicting Chiquita will disappear, but they're stuck in this century-old business model, and they have a really difficult time thinking about things any differently.
Is there any niche here for someone to get in with a different variety of banana then?
You know, I tell people every single day that if you want to get into a possibly lucrative business, because the banana is the most popular fruit in the supermarket and the world, look into importing new bananas. That said, it is a daunting task because each banana ripens differently. Each banana ships differently. Each banana has to be grown differently. You need sort of industrial strength, capital, and know-how to get the product. But that said, the kiwi fruit was unknown about 20 years ago and was introduced and is now pretty popular. So there's know-how, and there, if someone was willing to invest, I think it could happen.
You know, when you go to the store, you can. And if you go to other countries or in the Caribbean, Latin America, well, in the stores, we see plantains or plantains, depending on how you want to produce it, say it. And then there's these little finger-shaped bananas. Are they? You're saying they're not different from the Cavendish bananas?
They are different, and some of them are susceptible to these banana diseases. There's about a dozen pretty virulent diseases. There are a few alternate varieties. We have a pretty good selection in Los Angeles because of our large Filipino population, but those varieties account for a statistical zero in terms of the Cavendish market share. And the banana companies have not had a lot of success with what they call the baby finger bananas. One of the reasons is that educational component in bringing in a new variety. Baby bananas need to be served much more brown than a traditional Cavendish to taste right. But most people are used to that visual cue that Cavendish gives, and so don't allow them to go brown. And that's been a real problem in getting people to actually like this variety.
How many of these varieties have you actually tasted, and how different are they?
I've tasted about, I'd say, 100 different banana varieties all over the world.
Wow. You got a favorite?
Absolutely. My favorite is called Ibota Ibota. It's a variety found, I discovered it or tasted it first in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Ibota Ibota, the word Ibota means fertile in Swahili, and this banana yields huge bunches. And so it's called Fertile Fertile. It's so fertile. And it is absolutely delicious. It has, you know, you could only describe it the way you describe a really interesting wine. It's got complex taste. It's got notes and colors to it. But unfortunately, it doesn't have the proper characteristics for import. And it's too bad because it's a revelation. Our Cavendish banana is a lousy banana. In India, the world's largest banana growing country, they call the Cavendish the hotel banana.
Wow. And there's no way to get us closer to that banana. Did you say it was in the Congo? It was growing over there?
In the Congo, there's similar varieties in Thailand. I wouldn't say there's no way. I would say that it will take creativity and guts.
Why not grow it locally? Tell it what prevents it from, you know, importing it. Does a banana have a range of temperature and humidity and things like that it needs to grow?
There are about 30 categories that the banana or 30 check marks that the banana industry has come up with to make a suitable import banana, one of which is that it can be grown in the regions where they operate. Definitely can't be grown up here in the U.S. But other ones include height of the tree, because banana growing countries are susceptible to hurricanes, so you want a lower tree. One includes how it indicates ripeness. Some bananas don't actually turn yellow when they ripen. And for Ibota Ibota, the problem is something called finger drop. Each banana fruit that we eat is actually known as a finger. And the problem is when you touch these wonderfully huge bunches of 20 or 30 of these bananas, all of the bananas fall off and their skin is torn and exposed. And you can't ship a banana that's already been opened. And that's the problem with Ibota Ibota.
But if you live there, it's easy to get it off the plant then.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And in fact, that could be a good thing if this is a village banana in the Congo and you've got a bunch of people relying on this one tree, then, yeah, right. It's like a flip-top can. So, yeah, it works pretty well.
How certain is it that the fungus that's not in the Caribbean yet is going to get to Latin America?
Well, I'll say, first of all, that this is my opinion, and I will also say that this is backed up by most people in science who know, but it is not backed up by Chiquita and Dole who say we don't know when. The truth is we don't know when. The problem is that this disease is so virulent that it could come tomorrow. It's transmitted via no more than a speck of dirt on a shoe or a tool. Now, if I was in a place like the Philippines where the disease exists and I had some dirt on my shoe and I landed in Costa Rica and stepped on a banana plantation, that's the beginning. So it could come in 20 years, but it could come tomorrow. It's like one person who's sick wandering around the earth and you don't know when he's going to open your door, but as soon as he does, you're finished. That's the way it'll work.
Yeah, so it's that simple. It's something right, that lurks in the soil. It lives in the soil.
Correct. It lives in the soil, and that randomness. You know, the banana industry likes to say, "Well, it's a long way away because it's not here yet, and it takes a while." In fact, they need to prepare right now because it could come tomorrow. It's not a long way away or a short way away. But if you know a disaster is coming. And like out here in L.A., we prepare for earthquakes because we don't know if the big one's going to happen today or tomorrow or in 10 years, but we want to be ready.
Could you genetically engineer a better banana so it's not susceptible to this fungus?
Yes, and there's been quite a bit of good work involved in that, mostly done in Australia through a Gates Foundation grant. And there has been some success, but we don't know for sure how well these bananas will perform in the field in large scale. In addition, Chiquita and Dole and the other banana companies have promised never to sell a GMO banana. And in Europe, for example, you can't even sell a product like that. So whether you're going to solve that problem through genetic modification, which I'm in favor of, you may never have a commercial variety that can actually hit store shelves.
One quick question from Judith in Chico, California. Hi, Judith. Quickly.
Yes, I buy short, fat, red bananas at my local food co-op. Are these something that are also going to be threatened by this fungus?
Not this fungus. Those bananas, those red bananas, which is what we call them, are a relative of a really great banana called a Philippine lacatan. And those are wonderful, wonderful bananas. They're available at places like food co-ops or Whole Foods, not generally in regular supermarkets. One of the problems with those bananas is that they're quite fragile. It's hard to ship them in the quantities needed to satisfy the American banana appetite, which is about 25 pounds of bananas a year without damage and extraordinary handling measures. Mm-hmm. So they tend to be a gourmet item, and they are really good.
Well, thank you, Dan. You've set out the alarm bells here. For everybody to watch out for this.
You're most welcome.
Dan Capel is a science writer and author of Banana, the Fate of the Fruit That Changed the World. Great read. He joined us from KPCC in California. Thanks again.
Thank you so much for having me.
And if you want to follow Dan, you can read his latest story about bananas in today's issue of The Scientist.